Hello, I'm Alex Wisser. I'm a member of Kando School of Cultural Adaptation, and this is Groundswell. In this session of the Groundswell program, which was held as part of the Pulse of the Earth Festival in Bingara, New South Wales, participants from three of the seven collaborations undertaken as part of the project, an artist, a farmer, and a scientist, walk into a bar, discuss their experiences of interdisciplinary collaboration. The forum was introduced by moderator Lucas Eileen, who is one of the artists involved in the Artist, Farmer, and Scientist project. The five participants were Australian National University solar scientist Bjorn Sternberg, Hartley-based farmers Erica Watson and Hayden Druce of Epicurean Harvest, and artists Georgie Pollard and Mark Schwartz. The live sound engineer for this session was Matthew McRae from McSound Electronics in Urala.
Going beyond our comfort zones is probably a theme that will run through our discussion today, I think, because I've heard it said many times, and I have said it myself, that the big challenges that we're facing in the world, they don't care about our disciplinary boundaries. They don't care if we're a physicist, and they don't care if we're an artist, they don't care if we're a mathematician or a farmer. They bleed out in all directions and cross over boundaries. And so as a person from a single discipline, my expertise might reach just up until the boundary of my discipline, but the overarching big problem doesn't care about that. So it exceeds my ability to grasp its wholeness as an individual practitioner of whatever discipline that I belong to. So there's this need and there's this growing desire to collaborate across disciplinary boundaries. And we, the members of Kandos School of Cultural Adaptation, are artists. So for us, it's about collaborating across the boundaries of the art world and going beyond the comfort zone of the art world. And it is a comfort zone for us because we have specific processes that we engage in. Go to the studio, produce some work, put it on in a gallery, read the reviews in the art magazines, go for funding through the Australian government, and the cycle continues. Maybe the subject matter that we deal with is to do with these big overarching issues, the climate crisis or whatever, but we safely stay within the boundaries of the practices that we belong to. So there's this desire, even built into the DNA of Kandos School of Cultural Adaptation, is this desire for discomfort, desire to go beyond the disciplinary boundaries of the community that we belong to. So to that end, the last 3 years, we've been sometimes you could call it brokering, or you could call it creating the framework for these kinds of collaborations to happen between artists, farmers and scientists in all sorts of different combinations. And those projects have happened all across regional New South Wales, and sometimes, in my case, up into Queensland and Victoria. And they've gone wherever they need to go, but they have had these kind of points of contact. And sometimes those points of contact have been in Kandos, and sometimes they've been here in Bingara. Those are opportunities for us to gather and share stories about the things that have happened when we've tried to collaborate beyond the comfort zone of our disciplinary boundaries. So, three of the eight or nine projects that are happening as part of Artist, Farmer, Scientist are represented here. So you'll hear some stories about them. They're at various stages of still being works in process or being finished. The relationships are all different, so you'll get a bit of a taste of how provisional it is and how the kinds of risks that people need to take when they do this kind of work. So we've got about an hour, and what I thought, this is going to be fairly free-ranging conversation. What I thought we'll do first of all is allow our panelists to introduce themselves and tell us where they come from and what community of practice or discipline they belong to. And the thing that kind of unites us all together in this panel under this theme of walking on sunshine is this idea that the sunshine is the kind of resource or gift that the cosmos gives us, which has enabled all of our projects in one way or another to take place. And so that idea, we've been talking about it in the last couple of days, photosynthesis as a key plant-based process that is so enabling and life-giving to this planet is also enabling and life-giving to these processes of cross-disciplinary collaboration. So we have with us Georgie Pollard on the end there, who hails from Kandos. And Georgie, you probably have seen her around, maybe participated in her workshops yesterday. We have Bjorn Sternberg, who's next to Georgie there, who's a research lecturer in battery storage grid integration program at Australian National University. Basically, he's a solar scientist. Yeah. And you can, I mean, one of the things that we do in our disciplines is we correct other people when they try to describe us, right? Oh, you're an artist. So what do you paint? Well, my grandma liked my paintings I did when I was a teenager. Okay. And then we have Erica Watson and Hayden Druce, who are from Epicurean Harvest, which is in Hartley, which is sort of between the Blue Mountains and Kandos. Yes. Okay. And we have Mark Swartz, who's an artist who is known to me mostly as a bamboo artist, but also is involved with lots of sophisticated fabrication projects. So he's someone who really knows how to make stuff. So Mark, Hayden, Erica, Mark, Hayden, Erica, and Bjorn, they are a collaborative team. My collaborator, Alan Yeomans, is having an operation this weekend, so he can't be here, so apologies from him. And we'll hear from Georgie about the various kinds of human and non-human collaborators that you've had in your projects. So what I thought we might do is just kind of introduce briefly the three projects, and then we'll take a deeper dive into them, and we'll allow conversation to emerge with our audience as well. So I might start with the supergroup here. And we've got artists, we've got farmers, we've got scientists, all in a collaborative team. Who would like to lead off giving us a kind of, in a nutshell, what it is that your collaboration, what's the shape of it? What's it look like? How would you describe it in the bar, if you walked into the bar, the Imperial Hotel in Kandos, and those guys who were having last night doing a pub crawl came up to you and said, hey, what are you doing here?
Oh, the burden's on me.
You pass it on to someone else if you like.
Just tell them you like your shirts.
So our project is looking at how we can share our resources to enable the farmers and each other to, I suppose, bring solar energy and solar electricity to a interesting place that maybe it hasn't been explored yet. Do you want to add to that?
we can add in terms of where we came from to the project.
What kind of speed dating perfect match process actually brought you guys together in the first place?
Well, do you want to explain that?
Also welcome to Juniper here.
Yeah. Hey, Juniper.
Erica, should I start with where Bjorn and I left off before?
Yes.
So Bjorn and I went on a residency to Kandos to find ourselves a farmer. And yeah, it was very romantic. And I was fixated on this idea of non-battery storage or non-chemical storage of energy. Because aesthetically it's super interesting. How do you move some weight of some kind up a hill and then lower it slowly to extract that energy when the sun's not shining? That's one simple example.
So you Mark and Bjorn have known each other for a long time. So the artist and scientist relationship was already established. Yeah. Tell us about that. Like, you know, what's it like to, you know, you start from a friendship, then you move to a kind of collaborative working relationship. Bjorn?
I want to make a joke, but it's not going to go down so well. It's It's been good.
It's been, I don't know about romantic. Is it joke at romantic might be a stretch, but yeah. It's been good.
So no, it was romantic.
Okay. Mark and I lived together about almost 10 years ago now, just thinking on the drive up. So that's how we know each other. And we've never in that... I don't think
put
we've
a picture
ever...
of where you used to live up on the thing here.
Oh, yeah. So we both used to live there. That's kind of a less interesting angle of it. Kind of where the photo is taken from, it then opens up into a big courtyard, and there's 8 units in general that all look onto that courtyard, and it's run as a cooperative, and so everyone's doors are always open, so you kind of, in the end, live in a 40-person share house. That's kind of the way to imagine it, but as a bonus to that share house, you have this quite large courtyard that has some palm trees and stuff in it, and kind of has this microcosm, and this perhaps a little bit inward-facing, but very... cool and interesting space. But Mark and I had never really collaborated on, I don't think, anything artistic. I'd helped you in your workshop before, but that's very much a beyond do this kind of relationship.
So this is a fairly typical relationship that we often see between artists and tradespeople, where the artist will commission the tradesperson to do some work for them, to fabricate an artwork, and there's a kind of interesting discussion about whether the thing is good enough. Is it functional what are your exacting standards in terms of the aesthetics that go beyond functionality, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think one of the threads that we can pull out of the relationship that I think all four of us have had is around what's the focus on functionality, practicality versus, one shouldn't say versus, or in relation to kind of conceptual communication, aesthetics. I think those have all been themes and threads that have been woven through this process.
Yeah. If anyone wants to pursue some of the ideas further that all of our protagonists are talking about today, on the Candos School of Cultural Adaptation blog, there are many blog post stories about the processes that the various artists have worked on. So in one of your blog posts, I think, Bjorn, you talked about these kinds of stereotypical approaches to a problem situation. So the artist comes at it from a kind of aesthetic point of view. How does it look and feel? What are its kind of formal elements? The scientist...
Yeah, I just wanted to make something that worked and was ideally efficient. That's kind of the stereotypical bucket of what I've spent my career in solar research and now battery research doing. It's like trying to get the highest amount of efficiency out of a system that you can.
Okay, so we've got two kind of different ways of looking at the world. And the farmers, Erica?
So we were looking at how it will function within our whole system and how it's actually useful. Mm-hmm. Efficiency is a part of that, as well as we really wanted to take an aesthetic perspective for it as well, because it was coming into our farm and wanting to look at it and be inspiring. So it was nice to have that conversation, but it was definitely like, what's its function and is it like, does it have a purpose?
So you're, I mean, it's quite appropriate then that you're seated between the artist and the scientist in that sense that you sort of touched on functionality, but also the importance of how its look and feel and experience is.
And yeah. I guess I can go back a step, and before we met these guys, we were, you know, the drought had started and we were sort of floundering for motivation. And we went down to Mona and saw Cameron Robbins' artwork that records the wind in both direction and speed. And that really resonated with us in terms of how we relate to the environment and our involvement with the climate quite directly, and it meant that we would start pursuing an artistic perspective on land management, and it re-inspired us and reinvigorated us to take that step. Magically, Laura called us or emailed us. I don't know how you knew we were thinking about that, but because I hadn't met Laura before, and... Yeah, she emailed us and it was sort of, just blossomed from there. Didn't know these guys knew each other beforehand, but we just were really excited to be part of a farm project that was taking it from a different lens.
Okay, so we've set the scene for the beginning of a kind of beautiful artist, farmer, scientist relationship. And that spark that came to you serendipitously from visiting Mono in Tasmania and seeing that kinetic sculpture that takes the power from the wind to make these beautiful drawings. So it might be a good moment to bring in Georgie, because making beautiful drawings which draw on natural elements is something that you've been exploring in your project too, as part of the Artist Farmer Scientist project, Georgie. And particularly, I think one of the things that you've done so well as part of this whole project is work with the living classroom and the form of the artist residency as a way of generating new work. And it's something that I think the group introduced to the living classroom as a concept, this idea that the artist residency is an open-ended format without pressure to produce an outcome and see what happens.
Yeah. And that's a process for everybody to learn. That was a process for, like, you know, when artists encounter other disciplines, you sort of have to let them know what it is that you do as well. And so that's a process of teaching, isn't it?
Just drilling into that for a minute, like, can you say more about that? So you encounter someone from another discipline, what teaching is involved?
Oh, well, just like what you were saying, like in this instance, we didn't know, we were turning up and we didn't know what we were going to be doing. So we were walking in and taking in information, digesting it, and trying to work out what we would do. But that would take time, and it's not something that you can just walk in with that understanding of what you're going to do and then fit it in with what everybody else is doing.
So it's a very process-based approach rather than an outcomes-based approach.
Yeah.
You've reached a point where a real focal point for you has been around biochar, charcoal and carbon sequestration. So maybe you could tell us a brief story about how you got to that, to where you are today.
I was very lucky to be given biochar in this process, and to be given a chance to work with Adam, who's been our MC this whole time, and Roy Anaya De La Rosa, who's a PhD in environmental science and teaches people about biochar all over the world. And so, but what was lucky about it is that learning about biochar, and there was this beautiful material that, you know, you can relate to an artistic practice really easily, as charcoal as to drawing. So it was interesting that very first thing that came up to convince the Bingara to take me on was that I could draw. So, and then we could make that connection real quick.
So it was,
and then,
it was something about your traditional artistic skills that was appealing.
Yeah, that was, yeah. So because I can do that, like that we slipped in that way.
Why was that particularly appealing? Because these days a lot of artists, contemporary artists, as you know, can't draw. And that's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Like, the art world is okay with that, but go on.
Oh, I had just been drawing a map of Kandos, and then they were thinking of a map of this place, which is also really good. Like, there's a lot of usefulness to traditional methods of making art. I think there's lots of things you can do with that. But it was great that suddenly, once I was in the door, I had my foot in the door, then it just opened up, and I didn't have to do that anymore. I don't even know how that happened.
So it was it began with this concept of a commission. It was like,
you've got these skills,
let's commission you to make a map.
Yeah.
So, but for you as an artist, that's not as exciting as the...
No, that's right.
...as an open-ended process.
Yeah. I mean, even when I did the map for Kandos, that was really me pushing into a space that that they were expecting something else as well. And so...
Delivering the wrong product on a commission is a...
Well, I think it's really interesting to... it's when people push together, you know, you've got your thing. And, I mean, isn't that like normal? We all do it in all situations where I have these expectations, you have those expectations. It's not out of the normal that when we get together as from different people, different disciplines, whatever, we're going to bump into each other. That's really normal.
Yeah. I mean, there is something, though, about, particularly for artists, this idea of bristling at having to deal with someone as a client, which might... That might differ from Bjorn, if you're working on a very practical, solution-based situation. Is that right?
How do you... Can you extend on that?
If Mark comes to you and says, I've got this amazing artwork that needs some solar wizardry built into it, he's essentially commissioning you to provide him with your services.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things I've been reflecting on throughout this process, or the most recent reflection on the project and process that we've had here, is that I think I'm currently in the School of Engineering, which is even more nuts and bolts orientated than physics was before that, where physics is still a little bit more blue sky, or kind of a bit more head in the clouds. But so we're very used to, if you come along, this is the output that we want. It's like, cool, we'll do the steps to get to that output, like, done. And what I thought was really interesting, I feel like you guys are in the middle of this a little bit, and Laura should go on where you're sitting, Lucas, is the end of
She's a matchmaker.
Yeah, and that she's very, very comfortable with dealing with it being a process and it being about the process. And it's interesting just being up here the last few days, and Mark is good at this as well. It's an art practice. No one says, I make this piece of art, end of story. It's not the output, it's that it's a practice.
That we use that's a good insight about our discipline, that you've noticed that we use that word practice.
Yeah, that's what it's always about.
But artists talk about, my practice consists of blah, blah, blah. So
yeah, and
practicing. Yeah.
Anthropology. And for farmers, there's something similar as well. It's not about growing one eggplant and then that's the end of the story. It's an ongoing process where it keeps continuously beekeeping the farm going. So I think scientists and engineers might be a little bit too focused or too comfortable with that object output end of story rather than... And it is science and research is very much a process, but it doesn't get thought about, I think, in that way and doesn't get embraced, which I think it should.
Yeah, that's very interesting. The process-based nature of science and what perhaps blocks the discipline of science from being seen as a process-based practice rather than an outcomes-based practice. I should, as the participating chair, I'm like the captain coach, which is always awkward, you know, because you've got to bring yourself into bowl at some point. So I'll introduce myself as one of the participating artists in the Artist Farmer Scientist Project. And if anyone else wants to, like, step in to chair me for a minute. Here's a picture of me and Alan Yeoman. So Alan, I would have loved him to have been here. He's been my collaborator on this project. He is an incredible elder in the field of agricultural innovation in Australia. He's the son of P.A. Yeomans and worked with P.A. through the 40s and 50s on the development of Keyline. Took the Yeomans Plough Company to where it is today as a kind of world distributor of these implements that for subsoiling, which, you know, are used as part of Keyline design. Keyline being, having such an influence on the development of permaculture and in regenerative agriculture sort of suite of tools. So Alan is a legend of the game. And Ian Millis, who spoke this morning, and he mentioned that we worked together in 2013 on a project about, which was kind of honouring the legacy of P.A. Yeomans, Alan's father. And when we, I'll see if I can find the picture here. This is a sort of, here we are. So we had an exhibition at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and it looked like people came along and they were like, I don't really see why this is art. This looks like a sustainable agriculture study center. And we're like, fine, that's totally fine with us. And Alan came down from the Gold Coast in his helicopter and there was a Yeoman's family reunion at our exhibition. And at that point, Alan came up to me and he gave me a copy of his book, which is all about how we can stop climate change using regenerative agriculture processes. And a booklet, and this is great, this is in the tradition of the Yeoman's family, is self-publishing. So
this little booklet, zine, pamphlet thing. And it's he called it the Blue Book. And it was all about, it was a kind of half manifesto, half political rant, half, well, that's too many halves, but half technical manual about this machine that he was in the process of inventing in 2013 called the Yeoman's Carbon Still for measuring soil carbon sequestration. So since 2013, he and I have been plotting and planning to work together in some way on this, and it never really got the opportunity to happen until the Artist Farmer Scientist project came along and was like, right, now's our chance. So the premise of our collaboration in some ways was a bit simpler than, like, the collaborations that all of my co-panelists here involved in have been, have had relationship developing elements, and so has mine. I mean, it's like I'm exactly half the age of my 87-year-old collaborator, so you can imagine, you know, there's a if there's a cultural exchange going on between artists, farmers and scientists, in my case there's also a generation gap collaboration to kind of deal with. Here, Alan, you can see there in the middle, standing just to the to Ian's right hand side. And here we are. So, but our collaboration was perhaps a bit more outcomes oriented. I had an idea, and then we worked like crazy to try and make it happen. And it was, can we get Alan's machine, the Yeoman's Carbon Still, into an art museum? And can we exhibit it as a work of art? And can we have Alan as an artist in the art museum? So it's a kind of cultural exchange that's like a lot of the artist farmer scientist projects are about artists going outside of our comfort zone and into farms and into the wild. And in this case, it was about dragging in someone who is not part of the art world and framing his work as his incredible cultural innovation as a form of art. And what we did was we set it up in the gallery. You can see there it's got a pipe that goes up to the roof. It's plumbed in. It bakes soil to 500 degrees. At which point the carbon burns off, and if you weigh it beforehand and weigh it after, you can work out how much carbon was in that sample of soil. So we were cooking soil samples in the gallery there as a way of demonstrating his machine, and a form of, I guess, education to a broader community about soil, because people, you know, often just don't even know these basic things about soil. That it contains organic matter is a kind of revelation, and that organic matter consists of, you know, 58% carbon, and that carbon, where does that come from? Through plant photosynthesis fixating into the soil, the stuff we've been talking about for the last couple of days. And this utopian idea that Alan had, which is that if you can measure that and then map it out over hectares of land and work out how many tons of carbon dioxide have been put in your soil, and if we can put a price on that carbon dioxide, then farmers can have an alternative revenue stream, which is an incentive for basically converting to regenerative agriculture. So that's kind of like, just to bring myself into the conversation so that and so that we can then, you know, start. If there are things that occur to others that you want to kind of heckle me about, then by all means, go for it. Okay, so it may be now an opportunity to take a deeper dive, because if I was sitting in the audience, I love concrete examples, and you're probably thinking, like, so what did they do? So maybe
I think that's not the point. That's what I'm taking as the point.
Well, it is and it isn't, yeah. Right? It's what did they do, but it's also, when you're talking about process, it's how did they do it? We don't know how to collaborate across disciplines, so the how is the what, isn't it? So, So we want to do both at the same time, but we do want to know more about what actually happened. So I actually have a photo of the supergroup here collaborating together. There's a photo of you guys collaborating here.
It may look like we're sitting on a porch drinking tea, but don't be confused. That's a supergroup in cover. We're actually...
Fierce discussion.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, so Laura was there that day, yep. Would you like a microphone, Laura? The selectors I want to have a word. Yeah. Okay, go on.
Well, for me, it was an interesting process, because when we met these two, one thing that really struck me was that it felt like we all came from a very similar socioeconomic background, with similar ages. You know, it felt as though there wasn't the kind of conflict that I was looking for in working with a gruff old farmer who's been salt of the earth forever. You know,
which we had engaged with that with other relationships, yeah. Other dating in Candles that weekend.
Yeah, so
this was the end of that.
Yeah, they were far more attractive than I wanted them to be. And but what was really interesting was that we quite quickly fell into our disciplinary roles, and it wasn't a straightforward agreement on what this project would be or what it would look like. For me, I wanted to make something that was really beautiful and interesting concept and so on. And you know, obviously the other two had different ideas. Bjorn's fixated on it being efficient, and efficiency and beauty don't always marry up nicely. And Hayden and Erica needed it to be something that was useful in the farm.
So what's it? In this case, you're referring to it, wanted it to be.
Well, yeah, okay.
And some,
so there is the point.
There is an it that's sitting behind us here as well, by the way.
So what I wanted to show before is Bjorn, when we were in Candos, Bjorn and I were looking at this non-chemical-based energy storage. If you go, and there's all of these high-line towers that are still lying around Candos. If you go to the next image, we're missing the other image, but I had the idea of having a concrete block. Concrete cement is important to Candos, and having a cement block that during the day would be pulled up by a winch, and then at night it would release itself and light itself up in some way or do something with that energy. As it fell, we would create this power. Through our conversations with everyone we met, we discovered that farmers weren't particularly excited about this idea. It's something that they do all the time. It's actually the main source of how they use their energy, is pumping water uphill and then releasing the water when they need it. It wasn't quite as revolutionary as I thought it was. When we met these two, we started talking about something that would become integrated into the farm, and how to integrate that solar, that energy production, the electrical energy production, into the energy production that was happening in the veggie garden already.
Yeah, and I think we're both scientists as a background to farming, and so we have that background, and then farming is like this new thing, which is you're dealing with just extreme complexity. So, and to farm regeneratively, you can't really apply the same way of thinking that we had when we were being scientists. Not that we don't use lots of things that we've learnt through that learning, but we can't apply that way of thinking to how we manage these really, really complex systems.
So you're saying
when Bjorn came and Mark together, we got really excited. But I think one of the things that we aimed to do, or just sort of blurted out, was trying to explain the complexity of what was going on in the farm situation in terms of solar energy and how we need energy to power things, but we also need to acknowledge that solar energy is this thing that is constantly being captured by plants and fixed and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, we were talking over the last couple of days, some of us, about this, our use of metaphors, like there's a kind of backwards metaphor that we sometimes use to describe photosynthesis, as, you know, every plant has solar panels, you know, like, so we're using a human technology that developed thousands of years after the original as a metaphor to understand the original thing. But your understanding, you've used this concept of the solar farm, is that right? A term, the solar garden?
Yeah, do you want us to explain that? Okay, I guess, in terms of what came out of it conceptually was we tried to think of how solar energy is utilised for technology in terms of like what Bjorn was able to bring in terms of trying to unhinge some energy for us to be able to do things in the market garden, the things we need to power our fridges, our pumps and all that sort of stuff. And we need to acknowledge that we do need energy to do that. And at the same time, we're using that energy to collect more energy in the same form using plants. And was there a way of integrating that solar capture for energy use in the market garden with the actual growing of vegetables in the market garden? So we sort of devised this idea of how could a solar panel structure in the market garden contribute ecologically to the functionality of our production system.
So this is your market garden here, is it, Hayden?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah.
And if you go to the other picture was...
just tell me when to stop.
And stop, yeah. So behind us there is like some rows of tomatoes, and underneath that structure we're growing like nasturtiums, which we sell in nasturtium leaves. And I guess that sort of was a living example of the concept that we ended up coming up with these guys was how can we use shade structures that are capturing energy to provide a better environment for something else that could be growing underneath it. And that's where...
So what we see Mark behind us is a sort of a prototype of this. Is that right?
Yeah, maybe Mark can...
Yeah, so playing with this idea of having multiple stories in a food forest, as it's often spoken about, and how the essentially all of these plants share the sunlight for when they need it and so on, and how we can intervene with that in a way that is not only just utility, but is also something that's beautiful that these two will engage with in every day of their working lives on the farm. And so this was, I suppose, the concept that we've gotten to is to have these solar trees or solar sculptures that sit high above the rest of the plants and will shade. So if you go, this is an image, you can see the shade. Sorry, go back to that first one. Yeah, you can see this is 2 o'clock on a summer afternoon, heat of the day, and those leaves are partially shading the more fragile lower plants and the lower story. And then if we come over one more image, and then this is 2 o'clock on a winter's afternoon when both those lower plants and the solar panels want to be capturing as much sunlight as they possibly can. So across the year, that will change. And the idea is that this sculpture will be somewhat kinetic, that it can lower to spread larger shade over those plants when necessary and raise to move that shade faster across the garden so that no single plant is under that. And the idea is that there's movement within... There's multiple different angles of movement within the sculpture.
Sorry, I just picked up something on the NASA missions where they had this simple device where it caught the sun so it would drive it so that the sensor always kept the panel pointed at the sun. It was a really simple thing, and I went, how easy is that? No technology, just gets in the sun, gets energy, moves, keeps it tracking, loses energy, spring pulls it back so it catches energy again.
Yeah, I guess one relevant thing of that about is the is in the winter picture, we don't necessarily want the solar panel. So it's not just about the solar panel capturing energy. We don't use much energy in the market garden in winter. So we're sort of better off having the plants having access to that solar energy. So just in terms of how... Yep, that doesn't really answer your question at all, but...
Well, like I live on top of the mountain, I get snow. Yeah. So for me, it's about growing. Once my soil hits 15 degrees C, everything stops. I've had heaps of rain, sorry, people. Nothing's growing, it's too cold. So I'm constantly thinking, how do I get heat into my soil? How do I keep that going?
So are you a farmer too? Is that what you're a...
If it's the ATO, they're going to say no because I sold my stock before the drought.
Okay, right. Okay, we're splitting hairs. But yeah, basically you're someone who has some land that you're the custodian of. 1,600 acres, okay. Yeah, so this is interesting, isn't it? Because this is what we were kind of hoping was going to happen, because we partly talked about how our three disciplines here are, you know, in the process of experimenting and playing with technologies and forms and a site, and still kind of searching for the point of where it really, where the rubber hits the road, where it really kind of finds what it needs to be. Is that is that right? And what's your name?
Phil.
Phil is kind of identifying something that would be useful for him out of what you've all been working on.
These guys could extend their growing period rather than cover it in a big plastic tube. If there was some heat element put into the ground, then that would heat the roots, and that still keeps that activity going whilst the above ground may be getting colder. Look, you guys are great. Right. You know what,
so we've played with a few different ideas that are similar to these, whereby, you know, this coexistence between the solar panel sculpture and the plants, I suppose, the technology and the native can engage with each other. So there's all sorts of, through smart city projects and so on, there's all sorts of ways of figuring out what's happening with the weather that this solar panel you need energy for. So we can tell the warmth that's in the soil, or we can tell the... And if these sculptures are next to coupled plants and so on, they can actually share that information to the farmers. There's multiple other ideas that we've been playing with that these sculptures will actually do, and what to do with that energy that's maybe a bit beyond just pumping water or, doing the keeping the fridge cold. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you kind of highlighted one of the limitations of what happened and where it all got difficult was the infrastructure, the money required to do all that stuff was beyond the scope of the project, and therefore that was an interesting point that came out of everything. Was like the conceptual side of the entire project was really, really well threshed out, I think, and we got a really good sort of complete picture of we just all learnt a lot from thinking about it, and then implementing it was the challenge. Was like, okay, we've had a great discussion. How do we implement this on a farm scale that does meet those functional requirements and stuff like that? And that's where it got tricky.
I just riffing on that theme of learning a lot, I just, now is a good moment to pass to Georgie, because through this process in your project around biochar, you've learnt a phenomenal amount, haven't you? Come from where you were to where you are now. Yeah. And I was hoping that, you know, you'd be able to tell us a little story about some of the processes you've been through. I've got a few pictures of some of the workshops you've done with Roy and Adam and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe bring us into the wonderful world of biochar and how it intersects with your understanding of charcoal as an artist.
Oh, yoy. Where do I start? Where should I start?
Well, here's a place to start.
Yeah, so is Adam still here? Is Adam still here? He's gone.
He's organized.
Right, okay. So here's Adam and Rui teaching me about how to make biochar in a biochar kiln. That is a fairly recent invention to be able to make it in your backyard. I can tell you about those processes. That's fun. So,
tell us a little bit about it, because how's this different from making a campfire in your backyard, for example?
It's shaped in a way that the gases at some point, a lot of the gas.
What shape is it?
It's a cone. It's a cone that's around. I think it's 2 meters wide and 60 centimeters down, and it's a certain shape so that as it gets to a certain temperature, those gases, and I've seen it, it's amazing. As you're making charcoal, all these, the combustibles come off, and a lot of them just escape into the atmosphere, and it's not just CO2, it's other stuff that escapes as you've got a fire going. But what you want is for them to be combusted completely, and so you watch this shape makes the combustibles go straight back in again. It's like a vortex.
So we normally would understand the burning of fire as releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. So why I guess it's counterintuitive to me to think of something like biochar as being a soil carbon sequestration solution.
Mm-hmm. So what you want to do when you're making charcoal is to mostly it's about stopping the oxygen from connecting to the carbon, so you maintain the carbon. So lots of the systems are involved with a lot of heat, decomposing those gaseous materials. but not connecting to oxygen, so in an atmosphere. And so what happens in this instance is the fire, you create your fire at the bottom, and as you add sticks to the top, the oxygen is sort of, which is up here, it concentrates at the top and it doesn't go further down to the bottom of the fire, to the bottom of where the charcoals are, the coals are. And so as you layer it up, there's less and less oxygen happening down here. It's staying at the top. But at the same time, it does reach a certain temperature that is not so good for making biochar. So at that point, you put poo on it. Or you water it down or something like that. But you put poo in it and in manure, and it's it takes up those nutrients. That's cooled it down, and then you start the process again. But you've got nutrient-infused charcoal.
And what would you do with that nutrient-infused charcoal?
You get it into the soil or on top of the soil as you can in... Please.
Can I just ask you what sort of poo...
cow manure or whatever manure. Like I was thinking I'd have. Apparently, it stinks. It's really terrible smell when you do it. I was thinking about I've got so much dog poo. Man. That'd be great, right? You can get rid of that horrible stuff.
Oh, that's. Yeah. I mean, and on your blog posts, which Georgie's written these beautiful, poetic, these kind of marriage of poetry and science blog posts on the KSCA blog around the concept of falling in love with carbon through this experimentation, this material experimentation. I think, you know, your long experience as an artist playing with materials and, like, really, you know, not just using materials in order to make a picture, but somehow honouring the materials for themselves has set you up for a particular way of being able to experience this process.
Well, that's nice. that's lovely. Yes, I think so. I don't know. Yes, I do have a certain relationship to materials, but that's really it's a weird thing. I really think of materials as being their own beings and their own sort of subjectivity and weird stuff.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's weird. I think that's actually at
it's
the heart
honoring,
of the matter. Yeah,
yeah, it's about honouring it. So let's say in terms of carbon. You know, all I did was worry about too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. But then coming to have an understanding of carbon meant that I could see it everywhere. It was in all sorts of things. So now I honour carbon wherever I can find it, and whether it's in the weeds or planting as many trees as I can. So it, transforming something that I feared into something that I now love has changed my perspective. And I hope that that's what happens, is that as we all change perspectives in terms of these practices, we start doing things differently just because we have a different relationship to them now.
Yes, please.
Sorry, Georgie, can I invite you to use this moment, given some people may not have heard you discuss the long sleep, and maybe people haven't quite made that connection, that Georgie is the artist who made the beautiful bed over there with the charred objects, and whether you... would give just a little summary of the inspiration behind that work.
I don't know how to talk about it, except that I found that bed for Emma, my daughter, and it was supposed to be her bed, but then I thought I could burn it, and that would look really good. But it actually brought together so many things that I'd been thinking about when the bed, like the long sleep, it's about putting carbon to bed, and so we're taking that solar energy that has been transferred to carbon through that very magical process of photosynthesis, and we can keep it in a stable form. Because once it becomes charcoal, it's not going to it's stable. It doesn't connect to other elements anymore. It's no longer going to connect or decompose, or at least not for a long time anyway, as far as I know. So it's just that furthering of that process. So rather than we've been thinking about plants, and that's a whole cycle, but how are we going to get CO2 out of the cycle for a while and put it sleep, but also in a way that we think is really beautiful?
So the long sleep is a really evocative metaphor that, you know, that the bed kind of brings to life. And it's hard to see in this photo, but on the bed itself, which I'd encourage everybody to go and have a look at, there's a whole lot of everyday objects that have also been turned into charcoal too. Would you like to explain what some of those are?
There's a toy train, and there are ladles and bowls and stuff that you would have, that I would have romantic attachments to in terms of the 70s, you know, the wooden bowls and stuff. And they were all collected between Candos and Bingara along the, from op shops between here and there. And I've got so many more, it's just terrible. I just keep collecting anything that's wooden. So that's another thing in my perspective. It's like, it's wooden, keep it, you know, and put it aside. So that's part of that.
And Georgie, this bed went on a journey to a conference.
Yeah, it went to a biochar conference in Tweed Heads. And that was amazing. Like, so there's all of these scientists giving all of these papers and I don't understand a word that they're saying. And I'm going, I can pick up bits of information, little bits here and there, and I could piece together some things. But there were so many amazing different things that people are doing. And in terms of collaboration, they're doing it, you know, people are doing little bits on their own and then bringing them together, which is a... And working really hard, and it gave me that sense that people are working very hard on this.
One of the stories that I love about the long sleep, the biochar bed, is that it very happily travelled to the conference. It's been acquired by the Living Classroom as an artwork in the Living Classroom's art collection.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was went to an exhibition in Sydney at a fancy art gallery. And of which of those three places do you think had trouble exhibiting the biochar bed? It's the fancy art gallery in Sydney.
Yeah, it's like kill all life.
They wanted to fumigate it.
They wanted to fumigate it, and which was totally against the principles from here. And it was an amazing process to go through. Luckily, because, well, part of the thing was Art Bank has a lot of collections of artworks, and so whatever might be eating the bed or eating something in the bed might eat artworks as well. Which I don't have a problem with, but some people do.
Well, it just comes down to this idea that what is an artwork? In the art world, an artwork is something that is inert and has reached a point of being static in relation to its kind of evolving life. So, you know, you're inadvertently, you didn't intend to challenge that, but it just revealed something not only about biochar, but also about the art world.
So
we have about 10 minutes. I reckon it might be a good point to... I mean, we could talk for a whole hour on any of these projects, but let's have some questions and discussion. Do you want to start us off, Laura? Yeah, you go. You go.
Especially now that Erica's free of her baby. I think this audience would love to hear you guys talk about how you see the energy cycles in your farm, and that we've had wonderful conversations, all of us, about how you see your farm as a cultural place. It's not just a place of growing beautiful food for fancy restaurants in Sydney, but there's a whole other set of things going on. So please.
Well, I was actually going to bring it up. You sort of brought up exactly what I was thinking about, saying that artwork was static and how yours is, I guess, transcending that static idea. Looking at our farm in terms of the artistic processes and then putting on a frame of the different cycles that you're mentioning. So there's the water cycle and energy cycle, which is light cycle or solar cycle, and nutrient cycle, the dynamic, community dynamics, which is, you know, microorganisms to humans, cows, etc. Looking at those processes in... For us, looking at them in an artistic way so that they're interconnected and expressing different points within at any given moment has been a really nice way of looking at the land as an artwork itself and how it continually changes with each season, with each day, with each, you know, time of day. I'm not sure if that's perhaps what you were suggesting, but it's been a really rewarding experience to... talk with both Mark and Bjorn and then bring that onto our farm practice and regenerate that, try and regenerate when there's no water cycle happening on our property. And that's, I guess, been one of the greatest parts of the project itself, but also a really interesting way of communicating our silo of farming with other audiences. So we've had a really, really, really great way of reframing the farm world that we get sort of put in or stuck in, and communicating regenerative concepts and farming concepts through that different eye, and looking at ecosystem processes as an inclusive thing and an art project in itself. It sort of also opened up a whole avenue of us wanting to do different art projects on our property. And being close to Sydney, we also were like, well, this is an excellent opportunity to bring people on and look at different ways that they can be involved with different processes, like the water and nutrient and solar processes that go on everyday life, on farm or not. And it's like incredibly engaging for people to be able to come onto the property. So it feels like you can transcend different cultural aspects through those processes, which is the fundamentals of life. Boom.
Such beautiful thoughts. And Bjorn, go on.
Yeah, just to take it back to the early dating phase of the project, I think that was something that Mark and I recognised very quickly and took away as a huge attractor to working with these two, was that they are able to communicate about these things and be very open, and we kind of just had found a lot more there. I think when we were kind of trying to find us a gruff farmer, there kind of wasn't that much being given to us or kind of openness. So I think when I unfortunately missed the picnic, but when you guys were talking there about how difficult it is for farmers to communicate what is such a profound, such a large, all-encompassing process, let's say, of farming and working and living on the land, that's a really hard... There's a really difficult step to take that from the individual farmer to the next step, be that to an artist or a scientist or a journalist in many cases as well. I think these guys do that very, very well. I think that's the first step that has enabled any of this to happen. I think without that, nothing would have happened.
So I'd like to open to discussion. If anybody would like to jump in, yes, here we are.
Any benefit in working with a gruff farmer then?
I would. Yeah, I think...
So this question is about gruff farmers and whether there would be benefit in working with one.
I think so. I think they come across gruff because, like we were saying, they don't necessarily have the language to communicate the vastness that they deal with every day. The concepts and processes are complex, like Hayden was saying, and they come across like, oh, it's, you know, just real dry. And there's a whole lot more to that when they're saying that. It's like they're feeling it. And that gruffness is just purely a language that you learn to understand as you work on the land or with the land.
I think I didn't articulate myself fully as well. To me, the challenge in the gruff farmer for an artist is that what I think an artist's role in society is to articulate things that are very hard to succinctly say. So essentially to put a long essay into a single visual piece that somebody can look at and go, aha, I get it. And I think one of the biggest challenges in Australia is that farmers aren't good at articulating on TV and on, you know, in social media and so on as a generalisation. And that's where that relationship, I think, can be very powerful. And I don't know if it happens enough.
Well, to follow on from that, sorry, that's where we found the resonance with the Cameron Robbins artwork when we went there and we were like, aha, like that really spoke to us. And it wasn't necessarily aiming to reach farmers who were, you know, at an art gallery. I did an art degree as well, so but went there and was just, yeah, we were both blown away, and it hit us without words, which was perhaps what you're saying, that art has the potential to communicate without words.
Yes, Vicky.
Thank you so much. It's fantastic to hear about all the projects. I have a slightly poorly worded potentially question, but I've just been reflecting on just all the talks over the weekend and noticing this I'm not sure if it's a tension or a symbiosis, but I want to get some of your reflections on it, I suppose, between this sense of this urgency of the problems that we're dealing with and this a certain kind of efficiency or parsimony or attempt to kind of, you know, adapt or die, but the sense of staking out the right path and kind of getting there as quickly as possible. With, I think, the excess that we associate with kind of creative life and cultural life and this kind of, I don't know, horizontal unleashing of these kind of creative forces to kind of create new pathways. So I suppose I just want to ask for maybe some of your reflections in doing these collaborations between this kind of, I suppose, the political, ethical commitment to these kind of environmental challenges and the kind of practice and this kind of creative practice associated with the kind of cultural life, I suppose, that we're thinking of.
Thanks, Vicky. So the question, as I can understand it, is partly around urgency and excess. So excess representing somehow the playfulness or the non-outcome orientedness of the art practice, or in fact, you know, one's relationship to the land if we go beyond mechanistic relationships. So if we're faced with an extremely urgent need to act, how can we have time to be playful?
Oh, I actually understood it slightly differently.
Well, you can sorry.
I'll just answer a little bit to it, because it's so interesting. I thought about when Rachel was up here this morning, and she said that there are all of these people who are working on these things underground and they can't stick their head up. Yeah, do you remember that? Yeah, and they can't stick their head up because they'll get it chopped off. And artists can stick their head up, so that and they're allowed that excess to be able to do that stuff, and it gives permission for people to like to be for it to be shown and out there. And if they want to chop off our legs, that's fine. Go for it.
This it's is all right. I've put up here a quote that I use fairly often by an American artist called Pablo Helguera, who talks about socially engaged art, which is the kind of practice that some of us are involved in here, where these processes are the materials of our work. But he talks about how what we do is we kind of actually ambiguity is the key thing that we have at our disposal that some of the other disciplines don't have. So like what you're saying, Georgie, that's what made me think of this quote, was this idea that we can stick our head up, because in our discipline, sticking our head up and saying, I don't know the answer, is actually okay. We have that as a unique kind of property of our discipline.
And also, and I think another unique property is an ability to hold on to contradictions, and we don't have to resolve them either. So.
Great, now I've got the mic. I think this is more of a comment, but because I'm also on the AFS project, and for me, being in the art space for me means I can play in the science and farming space and not feel judged, because I spoke about this like a few months ago, a few of us were on a panel, and I was losing my head. I was like, I don't know what I am. I don't know what I'm doing. And I was really like kind of nervous in the space, but I've just realised that art is giving me the chance to be the scientist that I want to be and to be the farmer that I want to be, but I don't feel like I have to have all of that identity wrapped around me. It's this playful space where I can just do what I want to do and feel safe. It's been a really great project to work on, to have that dynamic happening.
Yeah, I guess that ties into the change in how we started, how we were approaching what we're doing as well. It took the intensity out of it. It took heaviness. Yeah, I guess it also sort of redefined us in a little way in terms of when we started to share it. I guess there were lots of people listening to what we were doing when we started, and we were quite naive to, you know, we were learning as we were going, and we, yeah, that was intimidating in itself, in that you become a source of information, and we didn't like that. Erica liked it.
Just a question. So does the collaboration continue, and have these things actually been erected on your property? I'm just interested in what happens now.
Well, we're hoping that, we're going to continue to collaborate and to figure out. I think the next phase of our collaboration is to make a prototype of one of these leaves. This is the beginning of the prototype, I suppose. The reason I've just come up and built this first piece is so that we can actually stand around a physical object and point to it and talk about it. That to me is powerful. But we're really next trying to figure out going, okay, so if you have 20 or 30 of these solar leaves on the property, they're going to produce some significant power that we can do something with. At the moment, with our constraints, we're probably only doing one. And so what do we do with that power? How is Bjorn going to be satiated in this process?
Irritated,
so,
maybe.
So it's very much still a work in project, yeah.
So we've pretty much run out of... Urgent?
I can make it quick.
Okay.
You were just mentioning, because you've got the water cycles down, and so looking at other options, maybe bringing people in to have a look at what you're doing and doing tours or something?
Yeah. Yep. So we're still farming. That's 100% of our income. We grow vegetables and sell them to restaurants. And we are just adapting the way that we grow and what we grow to our water budget, I suppose. And the key point for growing with a lower water cycle is to cover your soils. So mulching and composting, cover crops, high-density planting, that sort of thing in a market garden situation. We do want to do more tours, more picnics or events on the property. I do have a 10-week-old baby, so a little bit distracted with that, gladly. And we do hope to... I mean, we just actually put in a key line dam. So talking about PA Yeomans, we just built one, hosted a big event and raised money for it. Did a crowdfunding in the idea of actually bringing the crowd to the farm and raised the money, most of the money for it, and then built this dam. Now we're just waiting for the sky to open up and fill it up. But wanting to do more things like that, educational parts. So Hayden said we didn't want to teach things, but we do. We sort of want to just share what we do. Sharing, not sort of preaching or teaching. And then... I guess, sorry, Lucas. I guess in terms of the water cycling, I just wanted to sort of make a point that animals are the area for water when there's no water falling from the sky. And I mean that in that microbiology stops to sort of function in the soil when it's dry, and using your animals effectively so that as moisture, so you're moving them through your property slowly, or monitoring your landscape and using your animals responsibly means that you end up having the moisture being held in the rumen, and they're pooing out the microbes that are able to create a moister soil. Yeah, so just wanted to add that little point there.
Thank you. Artists, farmers and scientists, we've run out of time for this session, so I'd like you to join me in a big round of applause for our panel.